It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert will be back on Monday. Coming up on Central Time, we'll hear from a Wisconsin photographer who's been getting national attention for his honest and sometimes eerie photos of vacant scenery in our state and beyond. First, last night's Republican presidential debate in Detroit has some experts asking if the Republican Party is on the verge of some kind of historic schism. There are only four Republican candidates left, and last night one of them was the subject of many attacks on the stage, Donald Trump. And even before the debate, 2012 presidential candidate Mitt Romney criticized Trump in a speech aiming to rally Republicans. Here's a piece of that speech.
He's playing the members of the American public for suckers. He gets a free ride to the White House, and all we get is a lousy hat.
Lily Gorin joins us now. She's a professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University. Lily, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on today, Rob. Great to be with you.
Let's start with Mitt Romney's comments. We don't often get a party's previous standard bearer speaking out so strongly against the front runner in a campaign. What do you make of this speech?
Well, I mean, again, I think a lot of what we're seeing in this election at this point is fairly unprecedented. And so Romney's speech sort of attacking one of the folks running and leading in the polls for the Republican nomination 4 years after he received it is to some degree unexpected and a little bit distinct, shall we say.
But does it make any difference? Are the people who are voting for Donald Trump listening to someone like Mitt Romney?
Not necessarily, no. And on some level, it may actually be sort of at odds with what Romney and others in the so-called sort of Republican establishment may want, which is, you know, to sort of peel off some of the support that Trump has in pursuing the Republican nomination. I mean, Mitt Romney is part and parcel of the Republican establishment, and you know, if Donald Trump is running against the Republican establishment or running against the establishment broadly construed, then he can make hay, as he immediately did, of Romney's speech afterwards.
So, yeah, if your main appeal is I'm anti-establishment, I'm non-establishment, maybe it's a big resume builder to have the establishment attacking you.
I mean, and that's part of what he's also said about, you know, Megyn Kelly and some of the other newscasters at Fox News, who he classifies as, again, part of the media establishment, attacking him as a, you know, it becomes part of his badge of courage, if you will, to have some of these attacks. At the same time, you know, not a lot of other attacks on Trump have necessarily succeeded. So this seems to be part of a broader, perhaps, approach of, you know, attacking him from all sides.
Well, speaking of unprecedented, let's get to last night's debate. And we're going to play this. This is a weird moment in a presidential debate. Trump started out responding to a criticism from Florida Senator, fellow candidate Marco Rubio about this hand size thing. We'll give a listen.
I have to say this. He hit my hands. Nobody has ever hit my hands. I've never heard of this one. Look at those hands. Are they small hands? He referred to my hands. If they're small, something else must be small. I guarantee you there's no problem. I guarantee it.
Lily, if 2 years ago I had made a movie and had a debate scene and had those lines as part of it and comments like that as part of it, I think people would have said, that's stupid. That's unrealistic. That would never happen.
Yeah, I think you're right.
So here we are.
Yes, here we are. You know, as many of my colleagues and I in the realm of political science analysis sort of said in August, oh, no, you know, Trump's not going to be the nominee, it can't happen. And many, many pundits on television sort of said the same thing. And now we are at a point where Trump has over 300 pledged delegates for the nomination to be the Republican frontrunner.
Talking about the Republican presidential race with Lily Gorin, a political scientist at Carroll University. So the strategy here for candidates not named Trump seems to have changed. The game theory used to say attack each other, try to be the last one in the race running against Trump. Now it seems like all the criticism is directed Trump's way, except, of course, for what Trump himself says. So why this change?
It seems to be a kind of, you know, coordinated, not coordinated, but sort of gamed out maybe theory that, you know, like Ted Cruz is probably not going to win in, or not going to be able to win in Ohio, and Kasich is John Kasich is likely not to be able to win or pull the delegate majority in Florida. So now it's sort of up to the folks who may have advantages in their states, like Kasich, where he's governor of Ohio, or Florida, where Rubio is one of the senators, to sort of run and accumulate those delegates, thus stopping Trump from getting the delegates in those states, and to continue to sort of have this like three-court press, if you will, against Trump to try to block him from getting to the magic number of 1237.
And then something gets decided at a convention, which used to be the way most of these things were decided.
Right, but that was quite some time ago.
Yeah.
Like really a long time ago.
So, I mean, this is a complex, nuanced plan that if this happens, if Trump goes into a convention and he's got the most votes, but not that majority, the most delegates, but not a majority, and then there's a confab and they come out with somebody other than Trump, that's going to leave a lot of really unhappy Trump supporters.
Yeah, and it's going to be messy. I mean, because even if Trump isn't the one who ultimately gets the nomination, who does? Is it Cruz? Who isn't necessarily well-loved by many of his colleagues in the Republican Party? Is it Rubio, who has a lot of support from, you know, essentially the Republican establishment, but has only thus far been able to win delegates decisively in Minnesota? Or, you know, of course, there's been some of this discussion is the convention then, if it were an open kind of convention in that regard, would the convention turn to Mitt Romney or Paul Ryan or somebody who hasn't been on a ballot and hasn't had people voting for him or her throughout the primary and caucus season?
That'd be something. Let's bring in a caller. We've got Charlie on the line in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, I was just wondering with the question, the fact that Donald Trump didn't go to CPAC today, is that do you think there's a chance that he might walk away from it, say I'm a winner, and then use the quote-unquote goodwill for him in the future for his businesses? Because maybe he didn't really think he'd be this successful.
Charlie, thanks a lot for bringing that up. Lily, I mean, on the face you say, of course not. That sounds weird and maybe outlandish, but we've used the word unprecedented a couple times already. Who knows?
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. And I think originally when he first started running and there was response and people were sort of advertisers were pulling out from or supporting him. And so I think his brand, various things that have Trump on it that are part of his brand have already sort of suffered a little bit of a impact from his running for president. So I'm not necessarily sure if he gets out of it now, if it rebounds to his brand, sort of improving the status of his brand. I'm not sure. But the suggestion with regard to him pulling out of CPAC is that he's going, he said he's going to Kansas and he's going to, I think, Florida. So there's a primary in Kansas and there's obviously the Florida primary, which is a winner take all. So whoever wins in Florida gets all 99 delegates in Florida. It's not a percentage outcome. And so I think he's, you know, again, he's trying to make the move where he's going to accumulate enough delegates to be the nominee.
He didn't go, as Charlie mentioned, as you just mentioned, Trump canceled his scheduled appearance at CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Committee, kind of the big festival for movement conservatives. What do you make of that decision?
Well, I think he probably weighed his options in terms of, like, would he have much of an impact or is he going to get more of the attack from, you know, folks who are in sort of the Cruz camp, because Cruz is usually a pretty important person at CPAC and some of the other, you know, sort of more conservative members of the conservative movement. And I don't know that Trump sort of felt like, I spend my time here, or do I spend my time in Kansas courting voters there?
Now, one big question is, if it is Donald Trump as the Republican nominee, do Republicans, do conservatives stick with him? Asked on the stage last night after a couple hours of attacks, his three opponents said, yep, we would ultimately support him if he's the Republican standard bearer. We had people like Congressman Reed Ribble here in Wisconsin, who's now not running for re-election, saying, I would not support him as the candidate. Other Republicans around the country, some saying the same thing. So what happens then? How big a split, or do you think people will mostly fall into line?
Well, I mean, I think there are a lot of people who would probably generally fall into line around the party's nominee. It's the party's nominee. And it's also about, you know, it's about down ballot races. It's about Senate races and House races and governor's races and so forth. And so it's about other you know, Republican officials who are on the ballot. But there is, you know, there are these now these public letters from people. You know, there was a 70 people signed a letter 2 days ago, I think it was, from the foreign policy establishment, people who had served in the Reagan administration, the Bush, both Bush administrations, as foreign policy experts, who basically wrote a long letter and said they won't vote for Trump. So, again, it's establishment individuals who are sort of saying that, and so that may be an advantage for Trump to get the nomination, and how many people actually stay home is unknown. It's always sort of hard to figure that out in terms of, like, leading up to a convention, whether or not there's going to be a really a wave of people who are like, I throw up my hands, I'm not going, I'm not voting.
We'll watch and see. Lily, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on today.
That's Lily Gorin, professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University. She was with us for analysis of last night's Republican presidential debate. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The last time we talked to Wisconsin photographer Carl Corey, he'd put together a book of stark images that captured the sincere and humble realities of running a family-owned business in Wisconsin. His latest work is a photo series called Americaville. You can see some of these photos, by the way, right now on the Central Time Facebook page. Carl Corey, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, hi, Rob. How are you?
Well, good. Thank you. As we mentioned, last time we were talking about your photos on Wisconsin family-owned businesses. What are you doing in this new collection, Americaville?
Well, after doing that project and a few other very formal documentaries, I decided to walk from Hudson to Kenosha on the old Yellowstone Trail. It's a 480-mile walk. And I wanted to just kind of loosen up and not work to any constraints of a formal documentary. And what came out of it was this series of work, Americaville, which I guess focuses on, I know it focuses upon the cultural landscape. And that's kind of where it came from, and it's really just my observations about the cultural landscape. Sometimes I put lines with them that help the viewer understand what I was thinking at the time I made the photo, because I wanted to know what I was thinking when I made the photograph.
What kind of things were catching your eye on this long walk?
Primarily, some political type things. People's opinions about politics or religion or where they live, you know, the communities that they live in. I found it very interesting as I walked through Wisconsin that it's very diverse, and it changes so much from the northern part of the state as you walk down Lake Michigan, you hit Lake Michigan and then, you know, head south and down through Racine all the way to the Illinois border. There's definitely a demographic change that I guess I was aware of, but not quite as aware of as when I immersed myself in it by walking through it. And so that, you know, Americaville now, that experience kind of opened me up to look at it at any place I am with a different view.
And yeah, these are not only, they're mostly, I think, from Wisconsin, based on the sample I've gone through, but you've got things from New York City, from Kentucky, from Missouri. So you see things maybe in common? Americaville isn't just here in Wisconsin?
Oh, yeah. No, that's why the title is, you know, Americaville instead of, like, you know, Wisconsinville. I do see a definite thread throughout the country. While there is all this diversity, we really are all Americans, and we really are, you know, there's a common thread. And that's one of the things I'm trying to do. I was just out west, and I plan on doing another western loop this summer. So the reason there's so much from Wisconsin, really, I mean, is one, a reason of logistics. I live here. And so, you know, it's a rich state visually for me, for what the type of work I do. So, you know, that's why there's a greater number from Wisconsin.
Yeah. Now, one theme I see as I look through, a lot of you know, decay in some ways, or things not as they should be. So that might be a graffiti-covered wall in New York City, or a rundown business with a public auction in northern Michigan. So is that something, there's some desolation and decay going on in the series?
Well, I think it's an accurate depiction. There are observations. I didn't create these things. Mm-hmm. You know, they're there. So, and I'm not really necessarily just focused on them. One of the things I did realize when I walked, again, I need to go back to the walk, but is that Wisconsin may not be as economically sound as a lot of people would like you to believe. And that, as I walked on the Yellowstone Trail, these were just things that were there that presented themselves. I really don't go out of my way to look for these things. Like you say, the decay and such, but it's there. And I do think it's interesting. I do think there's a sense of history to things that are decayed. And a lot of times it might have a little more cultural depth, which is why I'm interested in it.
Talking to Wisconsin photographer Carl Corey about his new photo series, Americaville. We've got a slideshow linked on the Central Time Facebook page, including some of these photos. Carl, one thing I don't see a lot, almost not at all, in these is people. So you were trying to capture artifacts, kind of buildings and landscapes.
Great observation. Yes, I am. I feel that a viewer can immerse themselves more into a scene if it doesn't contain another person. So my work kind of is always that way. I usually have pretty empty scenes so that people can immerse themselves more easily into the picture.
Yeah, I guess if there's a person in it, our brain and our eye is going to be drawn to the person and maybe not the surroundings as much.
Exactly. It's going to be about that person. And I do portraits, and I love doing portraits, and I love taking photographs of people. But for this series, I wanted it to be about, again, the American cultural landscape, what's in the picture, not necessarily about the people that are living there, but yet I do think that the fact that this is, you know, an artifact as such, I do think it does say something about the people that live there. It's just not as obvious as a portrait of the person. And again, as I said, you know, I think that without a person in the photograph, it becomes much easier for the viewer to identify with the scene.
And I wonder, I mean, on this long walk across Wisconsin, you must have, even though you weren't taking pictures necessarily of people, you must have interacted with people along the way. What kind of encounters did you have on this long trek?
With one exception, everyone was great. And I was, it was a really wonderful experience. I live here for a reason. You know, I really like the people in Wisconsin. I like the people up north where I live, and I like going through Milwaukee, and I like the people living in the city that I met there. It was a great experience, and it was enriching. I liken it to a second degree, to like another my master's. You know, it was like a college education. It was well worth the time, and I would recommend anyone that wants to see something or see the countryside or immerse themselves into a city is that they walk through it. And there's no better way to acquaint yourself with a locale than by walking. And as a photographer, if you want to make good photographs, you have to be kind of you have to be intimate with and acquainted to what you're photographing. And that's why I really love walking.
And yet, do you feel like you connect more with the places you are, whether that's walking across Wisconsin or walking around New York City, because you're a photographer, because you're taking these pictures?
Well, yeah, you know, I'm in my early 60s now, and I've done it since I was 13. So, I guess that kind of attitude, my voyeuristic, so to speak, attitude has been pretty well honed. I can't separate myself from being a picture maker. I'm always thinking that way. I mean, whether I'm in a car, or whether I'm walking, or wherever I go, I mean, there's no such thing as a vacation for me, because my entire life is a vacation, yet my entire life is always also working. So it's kind of, there's no separation, you know. So, yeah, I a good photographer never leaves it at home.
So does that happen to you? Sometimes you're out for a drive or a walk or whatever, and you're not saying, I'm going to go out, I'm looking for some pictures now, but you just see something, and it's like, oh, okay, stop everything.
Yeah.
It's time for some photos?
Yeah, I always have a camera with me, and, I go to dinner with friends, I have a camera with me, so I always have a camera with me. It's something that a legendary photographer from New York, Jay Mizell, said, you know, is that how can you be a photographer and not always have a camera with you? And it struck me as a young man that I thought, you know, he's absolutely right. How many photographs have I not because I didn't have a camera? And so I don't have that excuse anymore.
All right.
When I fail now, so if I fail now, it's not because I didn't have a camera. So,
it's not a sin of omission. Carl, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
You too. Carl Corey is a photographer based in River Falls. We've been talking about his new photo series. It's called Americaville. We've got a sampling, a little slideshow of that photo series. You can find that over at the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert will be back with me on Monday. Girl Scout cookie season is one of the best seasons. You can pick up delicious cookies from the sales representative from your local Girl Scout troop, but you can only get these cookies a few months out of the year, and they don't last long, in my experience. So what are we supposed to do for the rest of the year? Our next guest has an answer. She wrote a piece for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel food section about how to make Girl Scout-style cookies at home. You can find a link to that piece on the Central Time Facebook page. We want to hear from you now. What's your favorite Girl Scout cookie? Have you ever tried to make Girl Scout cookies or other store-bought type cookies or treats at home? How'd it go? Did it work? And do you ever pair Girl Scout cookies with other desserts or foods? Do you have a wine and cookie pairing preference? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Alicia Witwicky joins us now to talk about making our own Girl Scout cookies at home. She's a Milwaukee area food writer. Alicia, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. Thanks so much for having me.
So what led you to tackle this challenge of finding good recipes to make Girl Scout style cookies at home?
So it actually started last year. I wrote a different article for the Journal Sentinel all about using leftover Girl Scout cookies if you actually had any leftover.
Wait, what?
Yeah, I know.
You're saying words that don't make any sense. Leftover Girl Scout cookies. Oh, I'm sorry, I interrupted. Go on.
So if you do have leftover cookies, there are so many cool things you could do with them. Like, for example, I made Thin Mint brownies, which were excellent. I also use Thin Mints to make my own, like, Shamrock Shake that you can find at McDonald's. So this year, I thought, you know, why not try to tackle how to make the exact cookies. So I've always kind of had this in my mind, and this year I just felt like it was the year to finally do it.
Now, to clarify, before we get angry calls and emails, you're not suggesting that people not buy Girl Scout cookies, the originals. You're doing something in addition here, not instead, right?
Exactly. It is so important to support the Girl Scouts because when they sell their cookies, it really helps the girls with their entrepreneurship and the confidence they get from selling cookies. So definitely keep supporting your local Girl Scouts. But if you run out of cookies or just really want to get creative in the kitchen, trying the homemade version is really something fun that you can do.
Now, you went kind of hunting around online for recipes to test out. Are a lot of people trying to do this, trying to make their own Girl Scout style cookies?
I would say so. I have been on Pinterest for a few years, and kind of in my feed, I would see things like this. More often, I would see recipes that use Girl Scout cookies, so I had to do a little bit of digging to find, okay, how do I make my own peanut butter sandwich cookie or Thin Mint? So basically, you know, I've been cooking and baking for so many years that once I found recipes, I would really make sure to read through them to see what kind of ingredients they used, would it make sense? because not everything you're going to find online is going to be a knockout. Thankfully, all of the ones that I picked, all of the ones that are printed in our paper, are all winners that I would recommend to anyone to try.
And you had a dedicated taste tester, I understand.
Yes, so my fiancé, Brenton Gaspiderik, tasted all of my cookies, and he said that his favorites by far were the Caramel Delights, which start with a shortbread cookie and have a coconut caramel topping, and they're drizzled with chocolate. I also had other friends and relatives try these cookies. My mom's favorites were actually the peanut butter patties, which have the shortbread cookie, a peanut butter filling, and then the whole thing is dipped in chocolate. So, but those were definitely the top two.
Yeah, I want to get back to those peanut butter patties because they're the best ones. But we have the Caramel Delight style recipe. In some places, they've been called Samoas, I think, in the past. We have the recipe on our website and on the Central Time Facebook page. So talk us through how we make these Caramel Delight type cookies. How hard is it? What do we do?
I feel like out of all of the cookies, this, even though to me it's so easy, it takes a little bit of time. What you want to do is start out by making just a simple shortbread cookie dough, which has, you know, your typical ingredients like butter, flour, sugar, and you make the dough, and then I think you chill it for a while because you want to make sure that the dough is really nice and chilled before you roll it out. I actually found the cookie cutter to make that perfect, like almost like a mini donut shape at Sur La Table in Bayshore, which is in Glendale, Wisconsin, and it was just the perfect size cookie cutter for that. So once you roll out your dough and you press all of your cookies, you take like the circular imprints and just bake it on a cookie sheet for maybe about 10 minutes. It's really quick. And then once that's cooled, you want to take shredded coconut and toast it yourself just in a saucepan on your stove, really light. And then you take those little caramels, like the square ones that come individually wrapped, and you unwrap them, and then using the caramels and some heavy whipping cream and then the shredded coconut, mixing that together, that's how you make that really good creamy caramel layer. So then once you put that on the cookie, wait for it to cool down again, and then you just melt some chocolate chip or baking chocolate, whatever you have on hand, and you actually want to dip the bottom of the cookie in chocolate, and then just kind of take a fork and drizzle some extra chocolate on top. And if you ask me, the homemade cookies are much, much better than the packaged Girl Scout cookies. I'd hate to say that, but they're just so homemade and fresh and delicious.
Are these ones that are really good right out of the, I mean, after they've cooled a little, but still warm out of the oven?
Oh, yeah. So basically, by the time you're eating them, mm-hmm. everything should be cooled down.
Oh, yeah, I get it. Okay.
Unlike like a chocolate chip cookie that you would make that's really good warm, you really want to make sure that each step of this cookie process, the layers have cooled. That way, you know, if you had like really hot caramel, for example, and then you're drizzling chocolate on top, it's just going to slide right off. So, but by the time you make them and they're all cooled, they're just so delicious. And they'll actually keep for a few days on your countertop if they can last that long, and they taste just as good. And another thing to know, I actually tried freezing these as well just to see how they would hold up. So I put them in, I have a vacuum sealer at home, and I vacuum packed a few of them and maybe had them 2 weeks later, and they were just as good as when I made them that day.
Talking to Alicia Witwicky, she's a food writer. She took on a challenge of making cookies inspired by Girl Scout cookies at home. We were just talking about a Caramel Delight type of cookie. We've got a suggested recipe linked on the Central Time Facebook page. So, Alicia, a thing about these cookies, a lot of them, looking at the different recipes, these are multi-stage processes. When I bake cookies, I want something usually I can stir up, plop on a pan, bake them, and then they're done. So none of these are quite that simple, are they?
I would say it's the easiest one that you're going to do is the homemade shortbread one.
Oh, yeah.
The tree cereals. So that's like the blue box that you'll find. That one is the easiest because all you're doing is making the shortbread cookie, kind of like rolling it into a log, cutting it, and baking it. So that one's by far the easiest. The other ones are a little bit more involved.
I have made shortbread cookies. It's been a while. But, yeah, that is pretty straightforward. So one thing, these aren't going to look like Girl Scout cookies necessarily when they're done. Like if you put them back in your empty package, you're not going to fool anybody into thinking they're eating the original thing.
Oh, definitely not. They definitely look homemade, but I feel like that's almost the charm in making them. Mm-hmm. Whenever you try to recreate any recipe or, you know, especially these cookies, they're going to look a little bit, you know, they're not going to be exactly circular. They're not all going to be the same, like, cookie height. You know, when they say, like, oh, cut all, you know, 1/8 of an inch thick, it's like, you know, you're not going to be exact the whole time. And when you buy Girl Scout cookies, obviously they're mass produced, so they're all going to be completely uniform and perfect. But I feel like that's part of the charm in them, is that they're all a little bit different.
We're talking to food writer Alicia Witwicky about how to make our favorite Girl Scout cookies, versions of them in our own home kitchen. Could be a good family project, I would think. If my kids are patient enough, I could try that with them. We're taking your calls, too, at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite Girl Scout cookie? Have you been out selling cookies this year? How's it been going? What is your favorite kind of Girl Scout cookie to eat? Have you tried making desserts with them? Our guest has. We'll maybe talk about that a little bit. And have you ever tried to replicate either something like a Girl Scout cookie, or I've seen people make, you know, Little Debbie or Hostess snack cakes at home? I've had really good ones, actually. One of my aunts made that. Have you ever tried to do this? Replicate the stuff you buy on the store shelf. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Get a recipe there, too. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, after a look at the news with J. Carlisle Larson. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our discussion now on Food Friday with Alicia Witwicky. She's a Milwaukee area food writer, and she experimented. She found recipes online, put them to the test. The goal, replicating as best she could Girl Scout cookies at home. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite kind of Girl Scout cookie? Have you ever tried to make your own, as our guest did? How'd it go? What do you like to eat or drink with Girl Scout cookies? Have you ever made a wacky dessert using those cookies as a foundation? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We've got a recipe there for a cookie very much like the Caramel Delights. We'll go to our callers now. David starts us off in Milwaukee. David, hi.
Hi. My favorite Girl Scout cookie, I will only eat the Samoas. We call them Samoas in Texas.
Yeah, it's different from state to state, I think. We get Caramel Delights in some places, too. Why do you like them so much?
I don't even know. it's so delicious. It's like the perfect combination of caramel chocolate, and I'm a diehard on coconut. And my roommate, he was supporting his niece. He bought, I think it was like around $130 worth of Samoas.
Whoa.
Yeah. And, we're getting through them all right.
How many more do you have left after that, $130 worth of them?
Oh, roughly 15 or so boxes, I'd say.
Okay. Well, pace yourself, David. Don't eat them all at once. So, Alicia, I don't think I asked, what is your personal favorite?
You know what? I'm probably in the minority, but I really love the peanut butter oatmeal sandwich cookies.
Oh, those are really good, too. Yeah.
Yeah, they're called the Do-Si-Dos. I love, like, ripping them apart, and then I'll lick all the filling, and then I'll just kind of, like, let the cookie part dissolve in my mouth, and I'll make it last as long as I can.
Oh, yeah, those are great cookies. Well, David, thanks for that call. You can share your cookies with us if you need to. We can help you. We'll go next to Heather on the line in Madison. Heather, hi.
Hi there. I have two things. One, I have made what I would say a faux thin mint.
Okay.
And not truly from scratch. This recipe is super easy. It's two ingredients from the grocery store. It's Ritz crackers and mint-flavored chocolate chips melted. So you dip
okay.
the Ritz cracker into the chocolate, and then let them cool. And quite honestly, you'd be kind of surprised. They really actually do taste pretty close to a thin mint.
I'll say, Heather, I would be very surprised. That sounds terrible.
I know. I tried it because my daughter wanted to try it. But she also sells Girl Scout cookies, and it's been a pretty good year. But I do have to agree, the peanut butter sandwiches are not a top seller by any means.
Huh.
They are one of my faves, too.
All right, Heather, thanks so much. Ritz cracker with melted mint chocolate chips around them. Alicia, you also tried to replicate Thin Mints, and you got a little more involved than that. What went into your Thin Mints?
So this one is a little bit more complicated than that. what you want to do is you make a kind of like the shortbread cookie, but it's with like cocoa powder in it. Hmm. So you're making a chocolate cookie. Then you're just cutting out little circles to create that shape. And then to get that mint flavor, you're melting chocolate chips, mint extract. And then once all of your cookies are cooled, then you're dipping it into the chocolate. If you ask me, that one, as far as the homemade goes, is the only one that doesn't quite hit the store, or I guess the real Girl Scout cookie. It's not as crunchy as the ones you get from your Girl Scouts. They're still really good cookies, but just that one was a little bit off. To tell you the truth, Heather's suggestion, I feel like, would have saved me a lot of time. Wow. So maybe I should have tried that one.
That makes me feel like the times I'm like, oh, I really need dessert. I've got some graham crackers and frosting. I call it graham cracker frosting snack. It just sounds like, yeah, make and do with what you got. But I guess she said we'd be surprised, better than it sounds. Well, we'll go to another caller. Thanks for that, Heather. I'll go to Alex now in Menominee Falls. Alex, hi.
Hi. I was wondering if she came across any recipes that were vegan or gluten-free, and if she wondered if those recipes would be just as good as the original Girl Scout type cookie recipes.
Oh, Alicia, anything like that out there that you saw?
For the most part, no. And I feel like I love gluten. I'm not adverse to like gluten-free anything. So I've tried those types of products, you know, from friends who've baked. As far as what's out there, you're not going to find a lot. I feel like those key ingredients, all of these cookies have butter in them, they've got flour, and I feel like if you really want to recreate the Girl Scout cookie, you need to use ingredients like that, or else they're not going to taste the same. I feel like if you want to try a gluten-free option or a vegan option and use maybe a shortening or something like that, I still think it's going to make a good cookie. It's just not going to be like a replicate, like what I was trying to do with my article.
Alex, yeah, sorry, but maybe search out the vegan and gluten-free cooking websites for this sort of thing, and I don't know, maybe you'll stumble across something. Thanks a lot for calling in. We are talking about trying to replicate Girl Scout cookies at home, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite Girl Scout cookie? Have you tried cooking your own, as some of our callers have? How'd they come out? 800-642-1234 is the number. Alicia Witwicky, a Milwaukee area food writer, wrote about this in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Nikki joins us next in Green Bay. Nikki, hi.
Hi, how are you guys doing today?
Good. What do you got for us?
Well, I'm actually working at the Green Bay Girl Scout office.
And oh, right now?
Yeah, we are. Yep, I am. And our cookies are just coming in. So the girls themselves should be out there dropping off their cookies within this next week, which is exciting for us because, well, me especially, because I love making brownies with my cookies.
So how do you use the which cookies, first of all, and how do you integrate them into the brownies?
Well, I like making mint brownies, and so what I do is I take the thin mints and take about a half a box of them, and I crush them up and put them in just with the regular batter I make with all my regular brownies, and oh gosh, are they good.
Oh, any other treats? That sounds great. Do you any use for the peanut butter type ones?
You know, I don't personally, although my favorite is actually the lemons on lemonades, and I love it with my lemon tea that I always have in the morning.
Oh, that sounds good. Oh, yeah, that'd be like biscuits in England with tea time. Brilliant. Thank you so much for that, Nikki. So, yeah, you mentioned earlier, Alicia, using thin mints and brownies. You've done this, right?
I have, and it's so interesting how our last caller talked about the lemonades. I actually use those. I crush them up really fine to make a crust for a cheesecake. So that's also something you could do with almost any of these cookies. If you really love the thin mints or just the regular shortbread, you could just like put it in a food processor, crumble it up really fine, and then you could make your own pie crust with that.
All right, Nikki, thanks a lot, and good luck distributing the cookies there in Green Bay. Janelle is with us next in Menominee Falls. Janelle, hi.
Hi. My question is for Alicia, and it's about wine. And I'm wondering if you have any ideas about wine pairings for any of the cookies.
You know, I am a white wine lover. I also love rosé. So I feel like maybe some of the more, not bland cookies, but like less, ones that have like less of a deep flavor profile.
Like shortbread maybe?
Shortbread, yes. Like that could go really nice with like a nice white wine, like anything that you like to drink. Maybe since I feel like chocolate goes really well with red wine, maybe if you were going to do maybe like a thin mint or even the peanut butter patties, maybe you could try that with like maybe a nice port wine if you like that. I feel like I would try that.
Wow. Okay. I'm not a wine guy, but I could see like a sweet port wine. I mean, there's a whole category called dessert wines, right? That could go with these little desserts.
Exactly. I feel like as long as you're taking the time to make your own cookies, you know, you're putting so much time and effort into them. When it comes to enjoying them, have them with whatever you like best. So if it's a sweet wine, if it's a really cold glass of milk, just kind of, you know, have whatever you want just to top off those cookies with.
All right. Alicia, what is either the next box of Girl Scout cookies or the next recipe of Girl Scout light cookies that you have planned to eat?
You know, I'm thinking I didn't have anyone sell, like come to my door and sell me Girl Scout cookies this year, but I always, whenever I'm grocery shopping, I'll always buy them from the Girl Scouts who are at the grocery store. So I'll probably be buying several boxes from them and eating all kinds.
All right, Alicia, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It was so great talking to you.
That was Alicia Witwicky. She's a Milwaukee area food writer. She was with us to talk about her piece on how to make cookies that are like Girl Scout cookies, but in your home kitchen. You can find a link to her piece and some recipes there on the Central Time Facebook page. Didn't get into those peanut butter patties. That's one I could actually see because those are my favorites. I think homemade ones would be really good. If you ever feel like you spend just too much time on your smartphone or whatever other gadget, tonight might be a chance to take a break. It's the National Day of Unplugging, an annual event sponsored by the nonprofit group Reboot. The plan? Put down the devices starting a half hour before sundown tonight and then stay off of them for 24 hours. No texts, no Facebook, no Twitter, no Snapchat, no funny cat games, nothing. A year ago on Central Time, we talked about the National Day of Unplugging with Tanya Shevitz from the group Reboot.
On this one day, we ask people to put down their devices for 24 hours or as long as they can do it. We just ask people to make an effort and to try to reconnect with the people around them, reconnect with themselves and the community.
What do you think? Go online and let us know what you think about this idea, you know, before you unplug from your gadgets so you can still get online. Do you feel like you spend too much time connected? Do you want a break from the technology? Did you try this challenge last year? Are you going to do it tonight? Do you wish other people would, people around you? Let us know on the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR. Then we'll round up the top stories from Wisconsin over the course of this last week. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.